Thank you. When I sent my proposed topic in for this lecture, for those of you who know Jamie suggested that I do a two-pronged approach, and I'll give you a quick outline of both of them. Whenever I do any defense of Christianity, I use a method that is not the normal or most popular method used by Christian apologists. But before I tell you what this particular method is and how it applies to the New Testament veracity, he asked that I also give you a quick outline of the typical way it's done. So I have kind of a two-tiered approach today. I purposely do not have PowerPoint-type slides because I think it's going to be a little distracting. There's so much material. I'm going to be flipping this thing continually and letting you... I was telling Lane before the deal today, I did a PowerPoint at another school a couple weeks ago, and there are 90-some slides in it. And after a while, you just kind of think everyone's, you know, get distracted by the... Now, you may disagree with me. My youngest son is in college. He came home the other day, and he said, "Dad, I got this professor." And all the guy does is stand behind a lectern and talk. He doesn't use any PowerPoint. He hardly even moves. And he says, "I'm sick of professors, so don't do something like that." And I thought to myself, that's me. That's how I lecture. So I'll try to keep you on your toes, but there's a lot of data to share with you today. But that's a quick outline of what I'd like to do. I'll give you a quick rundown of the traditional way that the New Testament is depicted, and then I'm going to tell you a different path. Now, before I start, let me give you a definition of each of them. The traditional method, I'm going to call a top-down method, or maybe you could say an umbrella method. And by umbrella, I mean you spread your data at the top, and then you have kind of a trickle-down to the next point you want to make. And the argument goes something like this. This is the traditional method. The New Testament is trustworthy, and it's trustworthy on two basic fronts. And I'm going to outline these for you in just a second, so you don't have to try to get these down right away, but to give you the outline before the outline. The first one says, it makes two general moves. The first is to say the New Testament text is virtually identical or close enough to the original that we know what the author said. And that's agreed to by virtually all researchers. That's not really contested. And the second move with the traditional apologetic is to say, we know what the author said, and every time we can check the authors out, what the authors say is reliable. So we have what they said, and what they said is reliable. And for purposes of today, I'm going to use the words reliable and trustworthy as synonyms. In other words, it's a good historical text, when it means to be historical. And then they're going to say, trickling down underneath the umbrella, they're going to say, we know what it says, we know that where we can check it out, it's reliable, and therefore, next step down, we can take the teachings at face value. That's the traditional approach, and I'll give you a quick outline. The one I want to do for you, I call a minimal facts approach. It's based on studies in ancient historiography, and it's the way we do Greco-Roman history and ancient studies of that nature. And it's a piecemeal method. Instead of the umbrella, we know this, so therefore we know this, so therefore we know this, it builds from the bottom up, and it takes blocks, building blocks. And it says, here's some tests for when you have a reliable piece of data. And when you get a lot of reliable pieces of data from these tests, which I'll give you a list of them, when we have a lot of reliable puzzle pieces, let's call them blocks, you can start building the case from the bottom up. Because when you have blocks, you build with them, right? So the first one says we got this big structure and we have a trickle down. The second one says, there's some issues with that. And we can discuss some of the issues if you want during the Q&A. But basically, the second approach says, now let's give some critical rules. And these are rules that historians apply to ancient texts, and they are the same rules that critical Bible scholars apply to the text. Not evangelical, non-conservative. They're the same sorts of blocks that the Jesus Seminar uses. How many of you know who the Jesus Seminar is? A lot of you, okay. They're the guys that throw the beads in the hat, and as one European scholar said, only in America would people throw beads in a hat and judge what percentage, make this a democratic process. Only in America do people judge what percentage it is that Jesus spoke certain words. But they reject between, depending on which level you use, they reject between 80 and 90% of the red letter words in the Gospels. But they accept these building blocks. Everyone accepts the building blocks. That's a pretty much unanimously accepted method. That's the second one I'm going to do for you. Okay? So I'll outline the umbrella approach quickly, as Jamie suggested, just so we get everybody on the same page. And this top-down, this top-heavy kind of approach makes two general moves. The first one says the text is accurate. Not necessarily reliable, just accurate. To give you an analogy, if we know what Homer says in the Iliad, if we have the text, the first thing you want to study, if you're majoring in classics, you want to know that the text you're studying is really what Homer wrote. After all, if you're doing your master's thesis or your dissertation on Homer, you want to know that you have Homer. That doesn't mean Homer's accurate. It doesn't answer the question of whether there was really a Trojan war or a Trojan horse, let's say. Doesn't really answer that question. But it tells you we have what Homer wrote. Then the next step is to say this text is reliable. So first of all, I want the text, and secondly, I want to be able to check the text with the real world. I want to check with data we have. And this, as I suggested, this would be applied to Homer, this would be applied to Plutarch, this would be applied to Livy, or Tacitus, or Suetonius, or Dio Cassius, or any of these. And when a person passes these two tests, we know what the author said, and we know that what the author said is reasonably accurate. We have, it's generally thought at that stage, that we have a good text. That's the way ancient history works. All right, now let me take this first one. Again, this is the traditional method. The so-called umbrella top-down approach. How do we know we have a good New Testament text? Why, for example, do critics really not dispute this point? One theologian said, evangelicals / other conservatives and non-conservatives, there's three steps. This guy was making a pretty good point. He said, everybody says the first step is, do we know what the text says? And both sides say, yes. We have what Paul meant us to have. Do we know what the text says? Yes. Do we know what the text mean? You know, there's some differences of opinion, but broadly speaking, you could have as many differences between a liberal and a liberal as you could between a conservative and a conservative. But generally, we know what a text says, and we know what a text means. The guy went on and said, the big difference is what do you do now? We know what a text says within reason, we know what a text means within reason, but is it authoritative? And conservatives say, if you know what the text says and you know what the text means, it's authoritative. Critics say, we know what the text says and we know what the text means, but Paul's a loser. Now, they don't hardly ever say that. Paul's kind of the darling of the critics today. But there's a lot of agreement at these first few levels. And the stuff I'm going to give you, if somebody was sitting here who was down on the Jesus seminar end of the study, when I start doing this, they probably just roll their eyes and I'm going to say, why are we spending time on this? I mean, it's kind of it's just not disputed. And it really isn't. But in the name of doing what I told Jamie I would do, give you a quick overview, I'll tell you why there's really not much dispute about the text. Let me give you a figure here to start with. A British New Testament scholar said a number of years ago that he said, we can be approximately 99.95% sure of the words in the text. Now, that's pretty good. But way back around the turn of the last century, around 1900, Westcott and Hort, two of the best known of the textual scholars, who had at that time about 2,000 Greek manuscripts, today there's about 5,500 or 5,800 Greek manuscripts, plus there's a lot more Latin manuscripts, thousands of more Latin manuscripts, but just Greek alone, about 5,500. Around the turn of the last century, Westcott and Hort had about 2,000. Now, I won't be able to slow down and do this. Somebody can pursue it during a question if you want. But the more text we have, the better able you are to ascertain what the text says, the more copies you have from a variety of areas. Westcott and Hort had about 2,000, and their figure 100 years ago was that we have 95% of the New Testament text. That was 100, that's a 100-year-old figure. 2,000 manuscripts, ...95% of the text. Today, about 5,500, and the latest figure is 99.95%. How do we get there? Well, let's compare the New Testament to ancient classical manuscripts. Okay, let's begin with that. If I want to know what the text says, I've got to have some good copies, because there are going to be variant readings. Let me begin with the bad news. We have so many Greek manuscripts in the neighborhood of 55, maybe more right now, maybe 5,800 Greek manuscripts. We have so many copies that there are just plain a lot of variant readings. There are a lot of variant readings. I'm going to surprise some of you when I say this. And this figure is old. But the last figure I saw a couple decades ago is about 200,000 variant readings in the New Testament text. 200,000 variant readings. You say, oh, 200,000. How are we ever going to get to the bottom of this? How are we ever going to find out what the text says? Well, there's a little epistemic thing here for you philosophers. You know how you can get, you know how we know there's 200,000 variant readings? Because you can count them. And when you can count them, you can work on them. See, when you can count them, counting them means you know where they are. How many of you have ever seen the red plastic New Testaments that are put out in Greek, that are the chief critical Greek text that you could study in any university? If you can study Greek, you can get this red plastic New Testament. How many of you know what I'm talking about? It's about this size. Some of you do. Does anybody know what is the bottom of every one of those pages? When you go open up these Greek New Testaments that Greek students study, whether you're in a private school, state university, wherever, when you're studying the Greek text, about half the page will be the Greek text. And there will be something at the bottom. There will be a line. Below that line, on every page, there's something there. Does anybody know what that is? Those of you who raise your hand, you know what's at the bottom page? It's called critical apparatus. Every major variant reading is listed at the bottom of the page. So if you know Greek, and you get to be really good at this, the bad news is that there's 200,000 variants. The good news is you can put your finger on them, you know what they say, and you can evaluate them. The 200,000 variations bothers nobody. Everybody knows they're there. They're not usually not aware that there's that many. They bother nobody because you can compare texts, and the New Testament is very, very wealthy in texts. Let me give you some examples. If you have 10 copies or partial copies of ancient historical texts like Tacitus, Pliny, Suetonius, if you have 10, you are doing well. You're doing well. If you have 20, there are only a very, very, very few classical texts with more than 20 copies. Homer. Homer's Iliad is an example. There are over 600 copies of Homer's Iliad. That's fantastic. So let's take the number one competitor to the New Testament. Okay? Number one competitor. Final score. Let's make this an athletic context. Final score, 5,500 to 650. First of all, you say, well, for classical text, 650 is fantastic. But don't look now, you just got killed. Well, you say, well, come on, it's not that straight a deal. It's not like a numbers game, like a basketball game. No, really. Again, we can pursue this in the Q&A if you want to. But for the most part, more texts make a more accurate reading. I'll tell you how you do that if you're interested. But the first indication that we have a good text is manuscript number, and there's no ball game. 5,500 to 650, and that 650 is the very best example. You might have 10 copies of Caesar's Gallic Wars, 10 to 20 copies of Caesar, Tacitus, Pliny, they are among the best ones. Okay? Second, the years, or I should say years, the gap. What is the gap between the earliest copies and the originals? Because the earlier the copies, generally, the better the copies, right? The earlier the copies, the better the copies. And we have most of the New Testament using the year of 100 AD. That's a nice round figure. Using the year 100 AD as the close of the New Testament, most scholars, liberal, conservative, place the Gospel of John at about 90, 95 AD. If we use 100, we have most of the New Testament using 100 AD as ground zero. We have most of the New Testament from plus 100, 150, something like that. Now remember, the smaller numbers are the better numbers here, because you want as small a gap as possible. The classical texts, a great example would be plus 700 or plus 800. And that would be Pliny, Julius Caesar, Plato and Aristotle. If you study philosophy here, or you take a classics degree, you don't realize, because pretty much classical professors, I don't know, I guess maybe they just don't think it's relevant. I've got a friend who took a classics degree at Cornell University. He was reading Plato in the Greek in their classes. The professor never said that this particular work by Plato is plus 1,450 years compared to 100 for most of the New Testament and about 225 years for all of the New Testament. So the gap is great. And lastly, is anything missing? According to most New Testament scholars, none of the New Testament is missing. Now, I'm not... If some of you want to pursue some technical questions, like, aren't there five letters of Paul to the Corinthians? Well, one from the Corinthians to Paul, which we don't care about, and three or four from Paul back to them, of which we have two. That's not what I'm talking about missing. Here's what I mean by missing. Let's say the book of Acts should have had, well, did have when it was written. Let's say the book of Acts had 50 chapters, and we only have 25 of them. That's missing. You see what I mean? Not... Are there books that nobody's read, that nobody's heard of, that we argue about all day, that fortunately there's no evidence? I don't mean that kind of missing. I mean missing like Matthew should have had 42 chapters and only has 28, so we're missing 14 chapters. None of the New Testament's missing. Whereas take some key classical texts, we only have about 50% of Tacitus, maybe the best Roman historian. He wrote 30 books of history. We have 14 complete books and portions of two others. So we have 15 of his books of history, and we might find them in a monastery somewhere, but right now, nobody knows where those other 15 books are. Livy, this is Tacitus. Livy wrote 142 books of history, okay? Over 100 of them are missing. We do not have them. We have about 40 books of Livy's history out of the 140 that he wrote. You say, wait a minute, problem. How do you know Tacitus wrote 30 books if we only have 15? How do you know Livy wrote 142 books if we only have 40? Because there's a couple ways you can tell. What if the books you have are numbered 157 and it's only your 30th, it's only the 30th one you have, but it's numbered 140? Another way is for Tacitus, we are told that Tacitus wrote 30 books of history. And when we count our books, we only have 14 and a half. So they will give you final figures, or maybe you'll have the last book, but you don't have a lot of the in-between books. So for these reasons, manuscript number, manuscript gap, and is any of the manuscript missing, it is virtually undisputed among New Testament scholars that we have essentially, what I say essentially, Somebody's going to argue about this point or that point. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in began to be discovered in 1947, scholars were amazed to compare Dead Sea Isaiah to English versions of Isaiah, different language, centuries from removed from each other, and as one scholar says, except for minor, very minor, does this text, this reading or that reading, the difference between English versions 1,500 years later and B.C., 200 B.C. perhaps, Dead Sea Isaiah, there's just nothing significant. So this is the old way to do it. Then the next step is, the conclusion of this is, we have what the writers intended us to have. And whether you know this or not, if you've ever gone to buy a Bible, you have probably made this decision without even knowing it. Let's say you want to give somebody a gift. Somebody wants a Bible. You want to go buy them a Bible. Just give you an example. And the person behind the counter says, hey, what kind do you have? I have 30 translations. And the guy says, well, what about something that's easy to read? And the guy says, well, I got a Living Bible here. And you go, oh, that is not a translation, it's a paraphrase. You see what you just did? When you say, that's not a translation, that's a paraphrase, what you've just done is said, that text isn't as good as other texts. This is called textual criticism. A lot of Christians think that Christians don't engage in textual criticism, but you do. Textual criticism has to do with the text. It doesn't have to do with the question of inspiration or whether the texts are accurate. It has to do with whether what we have is what the authors wrote. And when you say, oh, no, no, I like to read translation X, because I've done some reading, and that's the most accurate of the translations. Bingo. You just did this. You just drew that. You trusting somebody else's work. But when they say this is the best translation, that's why you go after that, because you want a good one. And when you say that's a paraphrase, you might say, well, I'd like to read a paraphrase. Fine. Go for it. You know? But when you make a point about getting an accurate text, and people argue about the NASB versus the NASV versus the NIV, there are some pretty interesting discussions about which text is more accurate there. Well, that's what they're going after. They're going after these things. Some of you may have been around a few years ago when I debated Anthony Flew here up on your stage the last night of our Veritas in 02. Tony, until just recently, was the best-known philosophical atheist in the world. He became a theist recently, if you heard this. It was huge news last month. It went around the world. At any rate, during one of our dialogues, he was asked by a student, do you question the New Testament text? Best-known atheist scholar in the world. And he said, by no means, the New Testament text is the best text in the ancient world. I'll just give you a little rule. The Old Testament, the strength of the Old Testament is manuscript quality. But the quantity of manuscripts is still very good. It loses to the New Testament. But the Old Testament quality is better than the New Testament quality. All right, the strength of the New Testament is its manuscript number. Both are important, quality and quantity. They're both important. The Old Testament has probably the best quality of any ancient manuscript. And its numbers, I believe, are second only to the New Testament. The New Testament numbers are number one, and its quality is probably second only to the Old Testament. But the strength of the New Testament is its quantity, the strength of the Old Testament is its quality. And by the way, manuscript, number, quantity will also give you quality. If some of you want to pursue that, that would be a question we could talk about. Okay, if you know what the text says, and this is largely not disputed, I mean, someone could hear me and someone could say, oh, that's a joke. We dispute the text all the time. Yes, there are textual questions, but I'm talking big picture. Are there textual questions that would change theology or would change our picture of Jesus? No. Not the big picture. Remember, we're doing an umbrella thing, the general approach. And here's the way I could best say it. I could come today with the most, what you give me what you think is the most liberal, New Testament translation, I'd be pleased to use it, and there would be no issues for my talks. So it's just not that much different. Now, Christians are going to get in there and say, yeah, but you know what they do with this verse and with this verse and with this verse? Right. I mean, there are some small things people are going to debate about, but big picture, you can generally use a text with, there's not going to be a problem. And they would be pleased to use one of the conservative ones. It's just not going to change that much. Now, this just says, all this says is, we have what the authors meant us to have. Now, how do you know what the authors wrote was accurate? Okay? I could have the Iliad and conclude that there's no such thing as the Trojan War or no Troy. But I still have what Homer wrote. I can still conclude. Oh, by the way, a little quickie here on the Iliad. The Iliad is only two-thirds the length of the New Testament. It's only two-thirds as long. It only has about 650 manuscripts. Would you expect more or less variant readings on the Iliad when the book is only two-thirds the length of the New Testament, it only has 650 copies compared to a third longer and about 5,000 more manuscripts? Which one do you expect to have more variant readings? New Testament. Just makes sense. Scholars disagree about, I mean, we don't have a lot of Homer scholars around, but I've seen figures anywhere between 10 and 25. Homer's Iliad has between 10 and 25 times more variant reading than the New Testament text does. That's quality. Shorter manuscript, only a fraction of the number of copies, and far more variant readings. That tells you the kind of text we're dealing with. Now, is it accurate? And I'm only going to put a few words up here. I'm not going to be able to argue these for you step by step. But here's where the apologist says, okay, we have a text. Now let's see if that text is accurate. And the umbrella method, second tier from the top, is going to say it corresponds well to what we know about the ancient world. And here's some of the methods they're going to use. First of all, you might talk archaeology. Archaeology is more valuable in the Old Testament than it is in the New Testament. But archaeology, and there's issues here and there with archaeology. But archaeology as a whole, when you can use directions, for example, that Old Testament gives, and find one of David's cities, Ezi and Geber, when you can find the city based on the Old Testament geography, you say, wow, this guy sort of knew what he was talking about. And archaeology is a good way to check some of this out. A second way to check this out is extra-biblical writings. Extra-biblical writings. For example, in the Old Testament, you might want to consult Josephus. In the New Testament, you might want to consult Eusebius. Actually, Eusebius, you can buy these guys in stores today, secondhand shops, bookstores of all sorts. You can get Josephus, Eusebius. But there are a lot of earlier sources, earlier than Eusebius. A lot of Christians are not aware of that. We have sources. If the New Testament ends, a good round figure, if ground zero is 100 AD, we have Christian writings that confirm the New Testament from 95 AD, Clement, 107 AD, Polycarp, or actually Ignatius, 107, Polycarp, 110, 3 years later. Clement, Polycarp, Ignatius, within 10 years of the close of the New Testament canon, we have writings that confirm portions of the New Testament. There's a fourth fellow, Papias. Unfortunately, most of his book, Expositions, has been lost, but there are some fragments, and these guys are real helpful. And here's one thing they're helpful with. Another thing this traditional view is going to say is authorship. Whoops. And date. Who wrote it, and when did they write? And the idea is going to be, I want somebody who's in the place where they can know what happened. Doesn't have to be an eyewitness necessarily. For example, traditionally, Christians say the first and fourth gospels were written by eyewitnesses, by apostles. Traditionally, second and third gospels were written by people who consulted the eyewitnesses. That's the traditional view. So conservatives don't say everyone's got to be an eyewitness. But they usually say, here's the rule. I want a text where the person was in the right place at the right time. I would like them to write as soon as possible afterwards, and I would like them to either have been there or to have consulted people who were there. And I won't be able to fill this in for you. You can do it during the Q&A if you want. But you put these things together, archaeology, extra-biblical sources. If you say you have authors who are in the right place at the right time, now you say, everybody admits I have the text. Now the text is looking trustworthy. So third step, I can use this text in constructing New Testament theology or talking about the historical Jesus. Chiefly historical Jesus would be maybe the next move you would make. All right, that's their traditional way. The top down, the umbrella, the trickle down effect. And it's a general argument and it yields general conclusions. One of the weaknesses of this method is because it is a general argument with general conclusions, it's hard to get specific conclusions. It's a little harder to push a certain point. But you can still make this one work. All right, I'm going to suggest a second approach, which I call the minimal facts method. Let me give you the minimal facts argument. I'm being facetious, of course. But a minimal facts argument would be heads I win, tails you lose. Now here's where I'm going. I'm going to say if the first general argument works, let's just take the example of historical Jesus. If the first general argument works, then we knew who the historical Jesus is. Now, if you say, nah, I've got some specific objections. I think you can make some good points that way, but I think you're going to lose too many small points. You're going to have some dropouts. With this second example, I'll tell you what. Instead of going the umbrella route, let's use the building blocks method. Here's the minimal facts method. I'm only going to use data that have two characteristics. The main one is I will only use facts, I will only use historical data for which I have multiple attestation. I will only use data for which I have reasons to believe that what this text says is accurate. Now, notice the difference over this and the other argument. The other argument says, well, yeah, you can know that text is true because we know what the text says, we know what the text means, so coming down like the umbrella, what the text says, what the text means, I probably have a good argument there. The strength of the second argument is it starts right on that point and it says, let me give you three or four reasons why this point is accurate, why this particular point is accurate, and then I'm going to build up. So the first characteristic of every fact I use is that they will be multiply attested, individually attested. And secondly, there will be widespread critical agreement across the board, liberal, conservative, moderate. There'll be a widespread critical agreement across the board that I can make this move. Those are the two characteristics I'm going to use. I'm going to argue specifically for that fact based on one or more credentials. And secondly, critics and conservatives will generally agree as to the meaning of this. All right. Let me give you an objection. And this, when I go to universities or around or my writings, this is probably the question that most people fail to understand. If you're here and you're a skeptic and you debate, I told the group last night I did this for 10 years. I used to debate with Christians. I was going to become a Buddhist and told my mom that. I remember that day. Finished my grad studies, told her I was going to go in that direction. I argue with Christians. I remember two places. I'm from Detroit, and I remember a couple places. One was an inner city situation. I remember two different guys that wanted to fight, both bigger than me, over my lack of belief in the Bible. When you talk to that kind of person, like I was, when you talk to kind of this village atheist, a village idiot kind of person, or village, whatever you call them, village atheists, they're often called. They use an objection like this. Maybe you've heard this. You want me to believe the man? Yeah. The man's in the book. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, I don't believe the book, so therefore I don't believe the man. Huh. I'm not sure where I'm going to go with that. You want me to believe the man? The man's in the book. I reject the book, so I reject the man. What do you say? And usually, now you can just give them the whole argument I just gave, but usually the supposition is this. With the village atheist, the armchair critic, usually the supposition is, if it's in this book, which is the New Testament, by the way, if it's in this book, you can't use it. Because this is your book. And it's prejudiced because it's written by Christians. And therefore, get it from somebody else, but don't use this book. Well, I'll make two responses. Okay, fine. Will you believe it if I give it to you from Tacitus? Who's Tacitus? What if I give it to you from Pliny? Would you believe it if I give it to you from Pliny? Two Roman historians who are not Christians. What if I tell you that Josephus said that it was widely believed that Jesus fulfilled prophecy, did miracles, was crucified by Pontius Pilate, and his Christian followers believe that he was raised from the dead? If I tell you that we get that from Josephus, will you believe it? There's a couple paths we can go. One is I did a book years ago called Historical Jesus, and I drew from 18 different non-Christian accounts outside the Bible to put together a life of Christ without ever opening the New Testament. You can go that route. And sometimes the village atheist is impressed with that kind of argument, but that whole argument misses the boat. Very technical skeptics, the kind I debate with when we're arguing in the print. And by the way, these guys are friends. There's no excuse not to be friends. Tony Flew and I have been friends for 20 years. There's no excuse. There's no reason we have to have an adversarial relationship with people we disagree with. None at all. There's a difference between exclusive beliefs and being a jerk in your actions, you know? And you just talk to two physicists, and it depends on whether they take the bootstrap hypothesis or other hypothesis. I mean, I just read an article with 8 competing views of physics. Because I take view 1 and you take view 4, that doesn't mean we can't have coffee or we can't be friends. But if you talk to some of the skeptics, they would never make the move that I just made. They would never say, I'm not going to believe it, it's in this book, go get it somewhere else. They don't do that. They accept whatever is in this book if you have good reasons for accepting it. In other words, they use the building block method. Let me give you 8 different building blocks you can use. And then what you say is, let's use historical Jesus. I'll try to give you an example of each. I'm really going to have to move to finish this up by noon or a few minutes before we go to our Q&A. But let me give you 8 building blocks that you can use to pick the best text. And again, the village atheist, that's not a derogatory term. That's often what they call themselves. The village atheist does not argue. I mean, they will argue if it's in the text, don't use that text. But that's not the way atheistic scholars argue. They'll let you use the text if you have good reasons for accepting that text. I did my doctoral dissertation at Michigan State years ago on the resurrection. Most of the guys on my committee did not believe in the resurrection. Why would they let me do a dissertation on the resurrection? Here's what they said. We don't care if you say the resurrection occurred. Just don't say it happened because the Bible said it happened. In other words, you can use the Bible, but don't use the Bible just because it's the Bible. Give us reasons why you use those texts. They're okay with that. Just give me reasons. Here's 8 building blocks you can use to put a case together. And by the way, you will see an overlap. Not only will critical, if anybody has questions, I will illustrate any of these 8 from ancient historians or from liberal theologians. I'll quote somebody else besides conservatives. But you know, if you're a reporter in almost any discipline, medicine, cancer that's detected early is better than cancer that's detected late. In any kind of inductive discipline, early is better. If you're a lawyer, if you're a judge, if you're a medical doctor, if you're, you know, anything, early is better. One thing I want to go for are early texts. Well, somebody tell me, what is the earliest extended report we have in the New Testament that argues for the resurrection of Jesus? I don't mean some isolated verse in an early book. I mean, what is the earliest extended text we have in the New Testament? Anybody want to take a shot? I don't care whether you use conservative. Actually, let's use, quote, liberal dating. Let's use their dates. What's the earliest text we have? Pardon? Biblical. Because they're going to use that too. Pardon? Mark. From about what? That's pretty early. Most critics are going to put Mark about 70 AD. Okay, if 30 is ground zero, if we use 30 for the death of Jesus, Mark is about plus 40. Does that make sense to all of you? 70 minus 30 is 40. Mark's about plus 40. What if I told you that virtually every critic who writes thinks that Paul is the author of 1 Corinthians, and that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 8, Paul gives a list, 3 through 7 in particular, Paul gives a list of resurrection appearances that dates from the 30s AD. What if I told you that Paul got this material in 35 AD, approximately, which is plus 5? Gerald O'Collins, a moderate scholar, not liberal, not conservative, Gerald O'Collins, a moderate scholar, says Paul's material in 1 Corinthians 15 dates from 30 AD. In other words, it's plus zero. That's early. That is early. Second rule, eyewitness. Whenever possible, get the material from an eyewitness or somebody who was with an eyewitness, someone who did good research. Good principle, right? If you're a journalist, you want to go to the game, not sit in front of your radio. If you're a judge, you want to get the facts. If you're a criminal attorney, you want to see what's going on before you make your case for or against. If you're a medical doctor, you want to get the facts before you prescribe. It's a very, very common tenet in any kind of inductive study, wherever possible. So what do? We use the texts that are eyewitness. What text do you have that are eyewitness? Most critics do not think that the four Gospels were written by eyewitnesses. Now, you can get around that by using the rules I'm going to use here. But you know who they do grant? The Apostle Paul. And of the 13 epistles that bear Paul's name, critics almost unanimously give you between 6 and 8. And the epistles they give you are the epistles that most Christians want to use. These are the unanimously accepted Pauline books. Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, Philemon. Often Colossians. 7 out of 13, and they're the big theological ones that are unanimously given. So you want to use an eyewitness? Or you want to get somebody who was there from the beginning? Go to Paul. That's what the critics would say. Now, if you want to say, wait a minute, I beg to differ with you. Papias says that Peter was the main source behind Mark. Okay, go for it. If you want to make a different case, go for it. But they're going to grant you Paul. You can make a case for the resurrection of Jesus and never use anything except 1 Corinthians 15 and Galatians chapter 1 and 2. And nobody disputes any of those three chapters. In fact, not only can you make a case, it's your best case for the resurrection, because it's early and eyewitness. Third rule. You've all heard two heads are better than one. Multiple attestation. We want as many sources as possible. And usually the word independent is there. But isn't that a good principle? Why did your professor give you a C on your paper instead of a B? One reason could be you didn't use enough sources. We still, you know, you're going to put a good piece of research together, get some good data before you start. And the best data are early data, eyewitness data, and multiply attested data. I want to come from different directions and get the same fact. Let me give you two examples. You know that Jesus is the only founder of a world religion whose miracles are reported within a generation? In any kind of holy book, he's the only one whose miracles are reported within a generation. Critics usually think there are five independent sources in the Gospels. I can identify those five for you. Think, wait a minute, five? Do you mean Thomas? No, I'm not talking about Gospels. I'm talking about Gospel traditions in the Gospels. Five traditions in four books. You know how many of those sources say that Jesus is a miracle worker? The Jesus Seminar says if you have two, you have a decent argument. Two out of five. Jesus was a miracle worker. Five sources. How many of these sources say he was a miracle worker? Five out of five. One of the earliest claims that Jesus made is that he was the Son of Man. Contrary to popular opinion, Son of Man is not a title of humanity. Son of Man is a title of divinity. How many sources do you have in the Gospels? How many of them say Jesus claimed he was the Son of Man? That's multiple attestation. Five out of five for the miracle claims, five out of five for the Son of Man claim. This fourth one, I'm only going to identify, it's a very difficult one. We can pursue it during the Q&A if you want to. but it goes by a couple of different names, discontinuity. I can accept something as being a saying of Jesus if I cannot track it to Jewish thought at that time, because maybe the gospel writers copied off Jewish writers. And number two, if I cannot track it to the church. So the things that are most trusted by skeptics are when the Jews didn't teach this and the Christians didn't teach this. If the Gospels have it, and the Jews didn't say it and the Christians didn't say it, probably Jesus said it. Now, I told you about the Son of Man a minute ago. 5 out of 5 sources say Jesus called himself the Son of Man. By discontinuity, Son of Man also ranks very highly. Because the Jewish writings at that time, 1st Enoch, 4th Ezra, books you probably perhaps not read of, or heard of or read, but Jewish writings for the first century, they have a Son of Man concept, and he's a lofty, divine, pre-existent figure, very lofty figure. But they would never say it was Jesus. They're not Christians. Oh, well, how do you know the Gospels didn't copy this from the early church? You know why? Jesus is never called the Son of Man a single time in any of the epistles. Never called the Son of Man. And yet, it's his favorite name for himself in the Gospels. So if you can't track it to Jewish writings, can't track it to Christian writings, Jesus probably said it. That's discontinuity. 5, Aramaic. If I can find sources, that have Aramaic substrata, I'm probably onto something. Good example, Jesus' famous mention of his father as Abba, an Aramaic term. Jesus probably spoke Aramaic, not Hebrew. And one of those terms, Abba, is a familiar term. It would be a name that a child. You know, were you ever around a great scholar, a major scholar, and have his son or daughter walk up to him or her and say, "Can we go get an ice cream? Will you play chess with me when we get home?" And you're going, "Well, hadn't thought about that." Well, this child has rights that you and I don't have, right? And so when Jesus says Abba, that makes people pay attention, and that's Aramaic substrata. Here's another one. Coherence. When I have a body of sayings that I think are Jesus's, and I have this other saying over here, which I'm trying to judge, if it coheres with, is very similar to what I've already accepted, then that one makes us look better. That's coherence. 2 more. Enemy attestation. If somebody who can't stand your guts says, "You are a loser, you cheat, you're not a good friend, you stink, everything else, but I'll give you one thing, you're a brave guy," chances are you're brave. That's enemy attestation. You've got one good characteristic and everything else, you're a loser. You probably have one good characteristic. And there are a number of things in the Gospels, this is a principle used in ancient history, there are a number of things that are attested by non-believers. For example, Jesus' miracles. That's a second way to go after the miracles. 8, the principle of embarrassment. When I don't say something, if I say something that's very embarrassing to me, either I just have a big mouth and I let it slip, or I probably have a good reason for telling you that. And sometimes in the Gospels, sometimes the disciples look very bad. They don't believe when Jesus talks to them. What about the fact that James, the brother of Jesus, was a skeptic? James, the pastor of the church of Jerusalem, who was known as a very, very holy man in the early church. How come Mark 3 says that when Jesus came to town, his brother James thought he was nuts? The Greek text says, James thought he was beside himself. Why do you say that about James, when by the time the New Testament was written, he was one of the most esteemed leaders? Because it's true. He didn't believe. So that's embarrassment. Okay? And what you do is you take things that are established from all these and you build building blocks from the ground up. And this is the way most people, this is the way most scholars do historical Jesus studies today. All right? I think either way can get you to the conclusion that the New Testament's reliable. You can either use the umbrella approach or you can use the building block approach. They both get you the conclusion that the New Testament's reliable. Okay? Any questions or anything I can help you with? We don't care on time? Okay.
Okay, we're going to now move into a time of question and answer. You'll have about one question to ask and then one follow-up question. And there's a mic here and one here, and we have a little bit of time to spend with this. So.
I know I said a lot of things. Don't be bashful. If I said something that's confusing, or if you said, hey, you didn't tell me how you get numbers out of this, or how numbers can prove a text. Yes, sir.
From your second method, what theology can you build from that? As far as, can you build all the basic theology of Christianity from all eight of those?
I believe so. Yeah, let me say a word about that, theology. I think sometimes Christians, I mean, any group, any political persuasion, I think there's a tendency to make a mistake because we think that the whole parameter of what Christians believe, if somebody questions something out here on the edge, we need to go after them and be real ferocious. How about denomination down the street from you? How about a church down the street and they don't quite believe what you believe? Let's say they're Calvinistic and you're Arminian or the other way around. Okay. Christians go after Christians. I think we should have a tiered theological system where the closer something is to the center, the better established it should be. And I think Christians, I think any religion, any political, any anything, should major on the major and minor on the minor, right? That's why I have a major and a minor in the university. You major on something, a minor on something else, and something else is even further down the path. If you do major only, those doctrines which the historic Christian Church, Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Protestant, have called, in the ecumenical creeds, have called the most important doctrines down through the centuries, yes. And the closer you get to the center, the bullseye, I think the center of the center in Christianity is what's called the gospel. The New Testament, over and over again, this is the single most important point. Jesus said the greatest command is to make sure your life is lined up with God. The second greatest command is to take care of others. Two greatest commands. And whenever the New Testament defines the gospel, three doctrines are always present. The deity of Christ, his death, his resurrection. You could easily get all three of these with the building block bottom-up method. And you can certainly get it easier from the umbrella method. I just think the umbrella method is not as tight an argument. I think it's a decent argument. It's not as tight an argument. But from the building block method, you can really go after these. And then, of course, for those of you who consider yourself Christians, the key, there's a fourth thing here. This is who Jesus is, what he did. When it's combined with faith, that is what Christians call salvation. So I think you can do all that with the building block approach. Yes, sir.
I noticed you have all those numbers. How does it come about when the more manuscripts you have, the more accurate it is?
Okay. Let me divide this room up and give you an illustration. Now, because you might be thinking, that's a real good question. You might be thinking, okay, on the surface, 5,800 manuscripts is better than 650, and 5,800 or 650 is better than 10. But how does you still have 200,000 variant readings. So how do you know which is the correct reading? All right. Let's say this room represents three major manuscript families. Now, here's how you get a manuscript family. Let's say there's a group of monasteries in this part of the world, and they copy manuscripts 24/7. And here's another early cell, and this one's in the Middle East, this one's in North Africa, and this one's in Rome. I'm just picking any old thing. And they copy like crazy, and they copy like crazy, and they copy like crazy. They have to, because we've got 5,800 manuscripts. And let's say, all right, so we have three manuscript families, and let's say here's the first manuscript family, here's the second manuscript family, and here's the third manuscript family. Let's say halfway through this family's history, right in there, somebody left a line out in the book of 1 Corinthians. They left a line out. But let's say because these manuscripts, these three guys are sitting here, let's say these manuscripts are right now, they are in better shape than these manuscripts with this family because they're newer and we're going to handle these things a lot. These are starting to get brittle. So people are going to start using their manuscripts. Let's say everybody after them leaves that sentence out. How do I know that that sentence should be there? Well, in the same family, up until that point, nobody left that sentence out. After you guys left the sentence out, there's a few people behind you who say, you know, I remember that sentence, I think, from heart. And they write it in from memory. And they leave two words out, but they have the rest of the sentence. Half of the rest of that family leaves the two words out, and the other half leaves the sentence out. So you could get 30 variant readings right here. But nobody before that point left that sentence out. This family, nobody left the sentence out at all. They've got their own problems, but nobody left that sentence out. In this family, nobody left that sentence out. So I argue, I don't mean me, but I mean people who do this, they'd say the sentence was left out and was left out right about there. Had to be. Because all the things before it don't have it. The ones after it have a variety of reasons. They don't have it left out. They don't have it left out. Now, what if they leave out three key words because they're of a theological persuasion where they hate these three words? So they leave those three words out of the text. And after them, some of the people leave those three words out and some don't. But before that, you guys didn't leave them out. None of you guys leave them out. None of you guys leave them out. Ah, we know what this happened. This happened right back here with this family. That's how they put it together. So the more manuscripts you have, with dates that are dated, and there's all kinds of ways to date manuscripts, the type of handwriting you use, the kind of material you put it on, where it was found, the type of ink or whatever that's used, the stuff it's wrapped in can be carbon dated. There's widespread agreement, liberal, conservative, moderate, on where these mistakes are. So the bare fact that there's 200,000 variant readings means almost nothing. Long explanation, but that's why large numbers are good, because in that sense, great quantity translates to great quality, if that makes sense.
I just wanted, because then if somebody starts leaving sentences out, it's going to say, well, people are going to say, well, then there's mistakes in there because they started to leave the sentences
right
out.
But remember my rules. Well, I already erased them. Early is better, right?
Yes.
And nobody across all three families, nobody left this sentence out early. They started doing it back there, or way back there. Uh-huh. So early is better, and that's why people agree. You can take every variant reading in the New Testament. Like I said, the bad news is that there's 200,000. The good news is we know where they are. And because we know where they are, you can apply these rules and come up with a reading. No variant reading affects a single matter of theology in the New Testament. No doctrine changes based on what you do with this variant reading. That's how rich the New Testament tradition is in text.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.